Mormon Stories Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation. All donations to Mormon Stories are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at MormonStories.org.
I think for me, you know, my relationship with Mormonism took a little bit of a turn for the worse around the marriage equality debate and the Proposition 8 debate. And I think as a result of that, you and your listeners may also know that in the aftermath of the Prop 8, there have been some efforts to try to address some of that. For example, Carolyn Pearson initiated a project to try to get people to sit down and eat together and have dinner. People from sort of, if I could say there are two sides to that issue, people from both sides to try to come to some mutual agreement. And we engaged in some of those activities and had people over for dinner. The thing I wanted to go to is, again, part of what motivates me to, motivates is the wrong word, part of what I've not been able to bring myself to do in terms of continuing to be either return to Mormonism or the negative experiences I've had around that have revolved around feeling like people have been, some active LDS people have been well-meaning in their desire to reach out to me and, as they might couch it or might characterize it, as being charitable. And I know there have been some different institutional messages that have come from the church hierarchy about taking care not to offend and try to have a civil discourse about this, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's well-meaning and may in fact represent some progress. The place where it doesn't work so much for me is I still believe there's this, that ultimately I'm not held or perceived equally in the midst of the LDS church. So a good example I can give you is, you and some of your listeners might have heard this story of Elder Marlon Jensen.
Marlon Jensen. Yeah.
Marlon Jensen, he, at the time, I think he's no longer a general authority, but at the time he was
a
member of the Quorum of the 70. Yeah. And at the time he was, had supervisory authority over the Oakland stake. And so post Prop 8, the stake president in Oakland had been organizing some sessions in wards across the stake that specifically tried to address some of the issues that had come up during the campaign and to try to do some healing around some of the pain that was caused. So
do you get the sense that the church lost members or, you know, people went inactive, that there was a price paid in the Bay Area for the church's stance on Proposition 8?
Don't have actual data to back this up, but my sense is yes.
Okay.
And not just in the Bay Area.
Right.
So I'm sure there are, I think LGBT people themselves, probably not so much, but their family members, people who cared about them. I think it had a devastating PR effect on the church broadly.
Right.
I think it probably hurt proselytizing on some level. I think Mitt Romney paid a price for it on some level. Anyway, yes.
Yeah. So, okay. Okay.
Yes. Yes. All of that. Anyway, so getting back to the story. So Marlon Jensen was in Oakland as the visiting general authority for the state, for a state conference that was happening. So the stake president organized this session that I went to with a number of other people, and it got some press because it was actually a really beautiful, interesting meeting. So it was sort of like a testimony meeting. A bunch of people had been invited, LGBT people, some that had remained in the church, some who had not, family members thereof, other, you know, bishops and other leaders. I don't know, there were probably 40 or 50 people in the room. I spoke, a number of other people spoke. Elder Jensen seemed to be really moved by it. he had made some comments that, not sure it was an official, it was, certainly wasn't an official church apology, but he sort of uttered sort of a personal expression of regret over how people had been treated broadly.
Were you moved? So, were you moved by his expression?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, absolutely. Thought it was authentic, was moved by it.
Okay.
Didn't think it was self-serving, didn't think it was planned or staged. So, but what I'm trying to get at is, so that happened in this meeting preceded the regular general conference, it was moving, great experience. So I decided to stay and actually attend the session of the state conference. And, you know, it's a pretty familiar story and format of the meeting. There were a couple of, I think a young person spoke, a member of the stake spoke, the stake president spoke, and then the general authority spoke. So it was, you know, pretty typical. But the point I wanted to make is when Elder Jensen got up there, he had just come from this meeting where he'd had this expression and where this is sort of all conscious and out in the open. And then I think without intending to, sort of as a default knee-jerk reaction, he alludes to the young man who had spoke to that started the meeting. And, you know, talked about his granddaughters and how this was such a fine young man and how his granddaughters would love to be interested in this, you know, in this fine young man, right? So, again, it's like this subconscious way of privileging heterosexuality without really stating it explicitly. So I was just thinking of the kids in the audience who are 12, 15, 17, whatever, who are starting to come to a realization that they might be gay or lesbian. And the message they get from the pulpit is around the normalcy of being straight, of the desirability of being straight. Here's a cultural representation of a fine young man, and any young woman would want to find this person and ultimately get married to this person. Like, that becomes the normal thing. So for me, it was just another indication that it would not feel good to me, for me and my family, to sit in the audience. I could be asked to come. And in fact, the stake president and his wife have extended to us numerous times invitations. Well, you'd be welcome in the ward in Oakland. And maybe we would be. But on a deep, deep level, there are sort of structural realities that would render us and our family as less than. And the messages that we would get, that my daughter would get, would continue to be that it's better to be straight. Straight's the normal way to do it. And that kind of an experience just wouldn't work for me and wouldn't work for my family. So that is part of what I've been trying to sort of reconcile a little bit is, you know, in terms of my own faith, I'm not a practicing Mormon, have, as I had talked about earlier, sort of moved on, have had issues with the theology, I'm forgetting the different other categories that you that your research has shown you, but I probably do have some historical stuff. I do have some issues doctrinally, but then again, ultimately, I wouldn't want to put myself and my family in a situation where we are not held up as the good people that we are, the tight family that we are. It just wouldn't work for us.
This is going to sound bizarre, and I don't want you to think that I'm asking this from my own bias, because I don't even love the question, but my brain's telling me to ask it, which is it possible to say, I as a gay man am awesome, I'm awesome, my husband's awesome, our gay marriage is awesome, our family is awesome, and a heteronormative family is the ideal? Is it possible to have those, you know, to not have to say, to be able to affirm in every way the choice to be LGBT or to have an LGBT kind of based family, and to say, yeah, let's encourage and foster healthy heteronormative families, because that's that's the way, that's the backbone of our society. And that's the way, that's the way most of our kids are going to choose to go. So let's do both. Let's affirm what you're choosing, and let's go ahead and say that's what the norm's going to be, and let's celebrate that norm too.
I guess in theory that would be true. In my experience, it's not done that way. It's the heteronormative way is couched in systemic oppression to marginalize and hold as less than the other way. So if I saw evidence that in fact there were people who it really, really didn't matter whether their kid ultimately identified as straight or gay, then I would say it would be okay to say we celebrate all kinds of relationships. There's going to be a minority of them that are LGBT. The majority of them are going to be hetero, and we support and care for all of them. But in my experience, that's not the case.
Got it. So this is a total hypothetical, but let's just say tomorrow Thomas S. Monson says, you know, it's okay to be gay, just live the law of chastity, and gay marriage is fine, and we support gay marriage, and he even amends the doctrine to say that there's, you know, gay temple marriage and exaltation for gays and lesbians and all that. I know it's totally hypothetical, but would that be enough to bring you back in, or have you moved on enough in other ways theologically and spiritually and dispositionally such that even an extreme move wouldn't bring you back? Or is there a part of you that's still irretrievably Mormon, and if the church were to make such a bold move, you would say, hey, I could do this then. I could go back.
I would not go back. So as you characterized it, I would say I've moved on. So I think for me, now, if Thomas Monson were to say that, that would, to me, be an indication of some change. And so perhaps that would then portend some additional changes, which would perhaps ultimately allow me to consider it. I guess what the ultimate thing for me is my experience with Mormonism, and I guess it has to do with sort of this duality between pluralism and fundamentalism, is I sort of see myself falling in sort of the camp of the pluralists, right? So if the LDS Church were a place that really felt like different views about all kinds of things, whether it not just pertaining to LGBT issues, but or issues about the role and the place of women, if someone could say, I don't fully or at all subscribe to the narrative around Joseph Smith and the First Vision, or if I could really say I don't, the doctrine and the dogma around the preexistence and sort of this sense about predestination that in fact my state and lot in this earthly life is a somewhat privileged one because I, in fact, was a vigilant person in the preexistence. Therefore, I'm advantaged over others. I'm using that as an example. So if in a pluralistic view, the church had room for people to not adopt the standard line and to have something that sort of joined people together that superseded or rose above some of those, what I perceive as currently sort of this more fundamentalist nature, then perhaps I would consider it. See, so for me, I see it more as a fundamentalist kind of a place that really there's one or a limited number of ways that one can be a good Mormon. And again, I have the experience there of it being kind of a dominant, oppressive kind of a place. So again, if the policy around how the church treats LGBT people and marriage were to change, I think it would be a significant marker in this broader sense, but that in and of itself wouldn't change it for me.
Okay. So the church would have to become the Unitarian Universalistic Church, basically.
Perhaps. I mean, let me just give you an example. Like, you know, one of Madeline's close friends from school was bat mitzvahed the other day, and she has two moms. And so we went to the synagogue is an LGBT synagogue in San Francisco. And so it was a room full of people, and it was she did her bat mitzvah, and it was really odd because neither of the two moms is Jewish, but their daughter's biological father was Jewish. So they decided they wanted to do this as a family. The rabbi is a queer woman. The congregation is made up of LGBT people and other straight people who sort of believe that that's the kind of congregation they want to belong to. I just found that incredibly refreshing. Like, I wanted there to be a ward like that. Like, where's the ward where it's okay for the ward as a group to sort of decide this is the kind of community we want to be. We welcome LGBT people. The bishop marries LGBT people, marries same-sex couples, and they're not marginalized, stamped out, rooted out, excommunicated, disciplined, etc. So that's sort of what I want. So in terms of this sort of more pluralistic kind of a way, I believe that there are other people from LDS backgrounds who sort of operate and revolve around the periphery in that sense. And I guess for me, I could potentially see myself as part of a community if there were the possibility that those kinds of people could self-form and still remain part and have some institutional credence given to them. I could possibly see myself taking part in that, but I think that's a long way off, if possible, even at all.
Was that a Reform Jewish synagogue or a Reconstructionist Jewish synagogue? Do you know?
I'm sure. I don't know Reconstructionist. My guess is that it would be Reform.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I think we've got a ways to go.
Right.
So, although we are acknowledging that a gay identity exists now, so that's, a step forward, right?
Yeah.
We're actually making a lot of positive progress, but yeah, we've got a long way to go. Real quick, do you ever feel an unfair pressure that your marriage has to succeed because you're like representing, gay marriage? And if, you get divorced, then that's going to speak ill of the prospects of gay marriage elsewhere.
I don't. Maybe I should, but I don't. It's funny. There are a couple of close friends of ours, two gay men who'd been together for, 12, 15 years, something like that. And they recently split up, and it was distressing to Madeline. She had grown up visiting them as a couple. They have a kid, and their marriage didn't work. It happens, right? So, as I mentioned before, marriage takes work. Jeff and I have had ups and downs. We're committed to it. I'm not the kind of person who would say we absolutely know we're going to stay together forever. So I don't feel that pressure I wouldn't feel that pressure even to stay together in an unhealthy relationship for fear that I would tarnish an image that somebody has of me. I think perceptions matter on some level, and I would hope that we both would sort of conduct ourselves in a breakup, if that's in fact what ended up happening, that would also represent our sort of totality as human beings and our being able to move on and continue to parent our child if we weren't together. Just knowing that lots of people split up and continue to be productive contributing members and raise good children and move on and have subsequent positive relationships, et cetera.
Right. Just for the sake of attribution, my cousin Daniel wrote up a lot of these questions for me this time. So I'm just going to acknowledge that I'm stealing a lot of his questions. But do you? I've heard that, you know, I've even heard Daniel talk a little bit about this, that sometimes, you know, gay and lesbian couples have options available to them that heterosexual couples often don't either have or don't consider as possible options. And, you know, one of those that you sometimes hear as being available, and I don't know if it's fair to say common, is that you could be in a committed gay relationship, but have the agreement that, you know, either or both in the partnership can have other relationships, even sexual relationships. And you also hear about, you know, just people who decide not to be in committed relationships. Something that they get that a committed couple does not get is variety. You know, I imagine that if gay marriages are similar to straight marriages, that there are times where, for example, sex and romance and intimacy takes a front seat role, and other times where you know, day-to-day activities and the grind and raising kids can make sex be sort of less of a prominent part of the relationship. And you could even imagine a gay couple where the couple would kind of get bored of each other or not as excited as they once were. And so you do, you know, you make some trade-offs in terms of choosing to be monogamous and to be committed. And I'm just wondering if you ever, you know, feel like you've given something up or miss or even envy some of the freedom that maybe your gay friends have who either didn't choose to be parents or didn't choose to be in committed monogamous relationships.
Right. Right. Well, for me, the regret I have is not so much about not playing the field, as it were. I regret not coming out earlier and having an adolescence that was sort of filled with more common, and I would say positive, kinds of dating and interaction. And, you know, because as I look back, I wouldn't say my adolescence and my young adulthood was miserable, but I think it was missed opportunity. Now, I don't know. Somebody might say, well, maybe you wouldn't have met Jeff had that been the case. And maybe that's true. But, you know, like, I would have liked to have gone to a prom with my boyfriend. I think that would have been awesome. I think that would have been great. I didn't have that opportunity. You know, I would have liked to have been open and, you know, and talked with my friends about the guy I was interested in just as much as I heard lots of people talking about boys talking about the girls they were interested in. I think that would have been great. So I regret that on one level. You know, I wouldn't be honest if I didn't say that I still now notice other men that are attractive. In fact, it's funny, you know, Madeline and I sometimes will talk to each other about about people we think are cute, you know, football players who we think are cute, actors, et cetera. You know, we do that. So, you know, and Jeff and I kind of have a, you know, we still have, you know, we both have our, as we say in the gay community, our gaydar, being able to identify other gay people. And, you know, so we notice when people walk past and are checking us out, and, you know, we do the same. So that's sort of part of the whole thing. I think that, again, similar to what I was saying earlier, I don't harbor any judgments about people who have had active sex lives with lots of different people. I know some of my friends who are in current relationships that I mean, I don't know the details of their sex lives. I presume they're monogamous. They're still together. Who knows? I don't have any knowledge that they're in open relationships. And then I know some people who are dating, who have been with lots of people who, you know, their wishes that they did have a sort of a regular sort of dependable relationship that they were in. So, yeah, I mean, it's I know I get a lot out of my relationship with Jeff on a sexual level, on a social, emotional level, on a friendship level. I think so far for us that the whole combination of it has seemed to work for us. I know that there are people, and this is not just limited to people in the gay community, that straight friends of ours too see their relationships and their sex lives ebb and flow. So for me, I haven't, you know, I don't live my life in such a compartmentalized kind of way where I'm either, I mean, I have a broad diversity of people that I interact with, straight, gay, bi, et cetera. And so it seems, I guess I don't view it so much from the lens of it being a primarily a gay issue, though I would agree that operating on the margins and not having the same rules and being able to define one relationship on one's own terms that LGBT people have had to do because they've been outside of the mainstream, because in fact they've had to, that's the way they've had to survive, brings a level of freedom that is really beneficial that I have enjoyed. So in fact, on one level, me being able to say, I'm in a relationship with this man. I don't care whether I get societal approval or not. It's what it is. You know, having the freedom to define that for myself in that way is really important to me. And I think it does give sort of a level of, I don't know, of different choices, different freedoms that maybe the constraints of sort of the typical traditional hetero union might stymie other people. But on the other hand, I think in my experience, most of the people that I've encountered, whether they're straight or gay or bi or trans, they're looking for the same thing. They're looking for companionship. They're looking for relationships that buoy them up, that allow them to go through life with some level of joy. And so hard for me to really distinguish them so much purely on the
sure
on the gay versus straight level.
Right. So we've talked, I think, a lot about some of the things you mentioned to me before we started the interview. Is there anything you want to talk about your job and how that relates, or do you feel like you've covered most of the principles?
Yeah. You know, I think I've weaved it in a lot. The one thing I would say is I made a job transition right about the time Proposition 8 was happening. So it was really important I was in this frame of mind of wanting to work sort of in the realm of social justice to advance equity for populations of people that are marginalized. And the immediate group that was in front of me was sort of LGBT folks. So I made this transition to this organization where I work now, where we do a lot of equity work, mostly along sort of race lines. And this, you know, I just think I needed to be professionally in a place where I felt like the work that I was doing was advancing some social justice and advancing some equity for groups of people that have traditionally and historically been marginalized. And just as I was talking about my own experience, even from my youth, my experience with Mormonism, feeling like it afforded me a lot of privileges that I was able to sort of leverage to allow me to be the kind of person that I am. I just it comes with me sort of a sense of responsibility to sort of work for a more equitable world because of what I have and the privileges that I've been able to amass for myself. So I know that seems I know maybe you're already thinking to a lot of allusions to sort of Mormon scripture or other sayings. You know, there's that song, "Because I have been given much, I too must give." So while I don't fully subscribe to currently to don't really consider myself active, you know, Mormon, that kind of sentiment still kind of resides in what I've chosen to do professionally. So at least for me, the work that I've seen is, at least in this country, race is such a difficult topic to talk about, and it still really is the marker of well-being and other populations who have been marginalized. That's not necessarily true worldwide, but it certainly is true in the U.S. So there are outcomes of well-being in our country that are totally associated with race. Racialized outcomes is another way to talk about it. Another way to think about it is disproportionality. So in the context in which I'm working, we're working largely in the education sector to look at educational outcomes for populations of students that haven't been served well. And you can look and see how graduation rates, when you disaggregate them by race, you'll see that poor educational outcomes are associated with populations of people that are Black and brown at levels and at rates that way exceed their proportion to the general population. So something is going on there. So that's the kind of work that we're involved in, is doing some leadership development with people to try to get them to understand some of the conditions, to have a discovery phase to sort of understand how these dynamics are at play, but then to try to exercise some leadership to take some agency to do something about it, to sort of create a different kind of an outcome. And the way that for me this relates to my work around marriage equality is that I really believe that people who care about advancing LGBT rights would be well served to sort of look at other manifestations of systemic oppression in our society, particularly when it comes to issues of race, as a way to sort of learn how systemic oppression operates, and also to try to sort of broaden and diversify the movement for LGBT rights, because as you probably know, and many people know, that in some circles, it can sort of be thought that the LGBT rights movement is a somewhat privileged, somewhat white kind of an enterprise. And there has been a lot written and talked about some of the, you know, rifts between the LGBT community, between African Americans, particularly African Americans that are religious or church going. And so I just feel like there, as part of my work, it would be important to me to use some of the sort of racial analyses, both to help inform some of the social justice and advocacy work that would yield some good outcomes for LGBT rights, as well as to connect some of the efforts in other communities that are also finding ways to lead and move forward towards the sort of adoption, attainment of a more equitable world.
Got it. Yeah, that I think somehow we're all going to win if we move in that direction. I guess you've talked a bit about how you probably still feel in many ways blessed or privileged by having been raised LDS. I'm going to guess that, but you can speak to it. I guess what I wanted to end with, I want to thank you so much for your story, for your honesty, your openness, for your thoughtfulness. I think this is going to be, this is going to be an interview that is really going to help a lot of people who are trying to tease out and understand these issues. So I just want to thank you ahead of time. And I want to close by asking you, you know, do you still, you know, in what ways are you grateful for your LDS heritage? It's a three-part question. Do you still consider yourself kind of a believer or spiritual in any way, or do you kind of lean more towards kind of the secular perspective? And then kind of most importantly, you know, in the LDS tradition, there's this thing we call the testimony where you talk about what you believe in. If you were going to close and offer your version of a testimony now of the things that you believe in that you think are most important, what would you leave with us?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I've really appreciated the opportunity to talk and tell my story, talk about my experiences. So, first, I think it's been evident. I do absolutely value the way I was raised and have some positive, many positive experiences that I draw on in terms of the way I was raised in the LDS Church. So again, I think for me, it connects back to a little bit to my sort of sense about social justice. I think a lot of the advantages that I have are unearned. So I, you know, there's a way of talking about this. A lot of people have a worldview in which they think that the advantages that they have are earned. And, you know, in my view, I think they're unearned. In fact, I have them. To me, it's accidental that I was born into the family that I was born in. Though I recognize and acknowledge a lot of the advantages that I've had as a result of that. So I think, like I talked about before, I've had access to a lot of opportunities that I wouldn't have had otherwise. And, you know, I think it's, on some level, I think it's interesting. I find myself talking about my Mormon upbringing a lot. I'm not closeted about it. You know, particularly in this last presidential campaign, I was a huge Obama supporter, but in my place of work, you know, there was an activity where we did together where each of us sort of we made sort of a quilt together of squares of, you know, paper, essentially, but you sort of represented something about yourself that would then be weaved together with some of your colleagues. And I chose to do a thing. I sort of had a visual representation of sort of a line of sort of a historical line from Joseph Smith coming up and then branching off and me being on one pole and Mitt Romney being on the other pole, sort of, you know, representing a, you know, a common legacy, a common ancestry, as it were, but then us sort of politically and in many respects being in very different places. You know, and people got a kick out of that. They were, you know, were curious about it and know me and know my background. And sometimes I like to surprise and confound people because people wouldn't necessarily think upon first meeting me, knowing that I'm gay, I have a husband and a daughter, that I came from a Mormon background. So I refer to it a lot. I reference it a lot. I think it's been instrumental. I think my particular family, I recognize the importance and the unique nature of how I was raised and what my family life has been like that I think can't be divorced from the many generations of Mormons that have been represented in my family. So on that level, it has been important to me. In terms of, I'm forgetting your second question. I know the third.
Do you still consider yourself spiritual or right. a believer right. in some way, or are you kind of more kind of yeah. gone the secular route?
Yeah, I have definitely gone the secular route. Don't really consider myself a believer. So, but I'm not sure I would fully say. Maybe I would say I'm an atheist. I don't know. It's not a topic of conversation, so I don't wear that as a, I don't wear the badge of an atheist as a badge of honor. I don't, but I certainly don't live my life with this sense. Particularly, don't have the view of the mainstream LDS view of what God is, who God is. Wouldn't even consider the way I operate necessarily to be spiritual, though I absolutely have and recognize, have lots of emotional experiences, connections with people, feel moved often when I come across people who are in need or I see some realization of some of the equity work that I'm working in get moved all the time. I tend to think of that as an emotional kind of a thing that happens with me in the connection with other people, and have ways of explaining it outside of a spiritual frame. But I think I like the way I live my life. I feel like I have a moral compass. I make decisions, I think, taking into consideration other people and their best interests. So in that way, I feel satisfied with sort of that secular way of looking, secular humanism, whatever you want to call it. Feel good about that. Feel
okay. Satisfied, content. Sure.
Yeah. So I guess then the last thing I would close with, it's interesting. I have a lot of analogies or analogous experiences to like testimony meetings in the way my work goes. I think there sort of is, for a lot of us that work in the social justice world or sort of the nonprofit world, where for us, questions of privilege and equity and equality matter. There's kind of a way you go about having those conversations that in many ways reminds me a lot about testimony meetings and all of that. So it's familiar territory to me. You know, I would just say don't want to be thought of as a role model, in that there's only one way to go about, living your life as a gay person. And in fact, the way I think of it is, particularly when it comes to my parents, I love my parents. I am absolutely grateful for the way they have supported me and the way they have chosen to live their lives in advocating for LGBT people. And at the same time, given who I am and the relative tameness, and I would say I'm vanilla, as it were, it hasn't been terribly hard for them, right? So on one level, I'm grateful for them, and they're coming to accept somebody who went and got formally educated, married the first person he met, had a family, that it's been relatively, on a broad spectrum, easy for them to accept me because I've been, it's been easy that way, right? So I think I would hope that my actions and what I intend to do, both in the work that I do professionally and the way I show up with my immediate family and with my friends, is to sort of work to create the kind of socially just world where people can be who they are, where there can be sort of a pluralism of thought, and where my experience can be listened to sort of with some perspective about what has been true for me, but and how that road may differ from other people. So I just am grateful for the opportunity to tell my story, and happy that we had the chance to talk.
Beautiful. And is it right now, is it someday your dream to kind of just to grow old with your husband and reach that 75th anniversary kind of thing and celebrate it with Jeff? Is that kind of what you're thinking right now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, Madeline's 12, and we love being parents. She's awesome. And it's going to be great when she goes off to college and Jeff and I can soon thereafter retire and, spend more time together.
That's great.
So that's the hope.
All right. Well, Brett Bradshaw, I want to thank you so much again for coming on Mormon Stories. I guess I want to kind of thank Jeff and Madeline, because whether they like it or not, their stories are being shared, and I'm sure they're a part of that. So thanks to you. Thanks to your wonderful mother, Marge, and your father, Bill, and your siblings that have all provided such an inspirational story. It's just it just seems like a great story all the way around. So thanks for modeling a life that will probably be edifying to many people.
Yeah, thanks so much, John. I appreciate the opportunity to chat.
All right. Take care.
Take care.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. Music today was provided by the Saber Rattlers. Check them out at saber-rattlers.com. The Mormon Stories logo was generously donated by StudioCase.com. Thanks for listening.
Come, come, ye saints, no toil nor labor fear, but with joy wend your way. Though hard to you this journey may appear, grace shall be as your day. Tis better far for us to strive our useless cares from us to drive. Do this and joy, your hearts will swell. Journey's through, happy day.